Access number 30135, Reel 1.
Fergus, I wonder if you'd be kind enough to give me your name, your age, branch of the service that you served in, and your rank, please.
Right, my name is Fergus Gordon Ancorn. That's A-N-C-K-O-R-N. I'm 88. I was born on the 10th of December, 1918. I was called up at the beginning of the war to Woolwich into the field artillery. And that's when the war started.
Right. When did you get posted far east?
About 2.5 years after. We were trained in this country for 2.5 years, and I believe we were the first division to go abroad fully equipped to the last nut and bolt and fully trained. And we had been trained for desert warfare, and we were heading for the Middle East, for Africa. And at that time it became too dangerous to go through the Mediterranean, so we went round via the Cape. And on the 10th of December 1941, on the 7th, on the American ship, because most people didn't know the Americans took us.
Right.
They weren't in the war. We were on the way to landing at Cape Town 2 days later when Pearl Harbor happened. And the powers that be must have then decided, right, we're being taken off the desert warfare and headed for the Far East, which was a terrible thing. They knew Singapore was about to fall. They knew that. And as you can see, my lorry over there on the wall and all our equipment was camouflaged for the desert. Blacks, yellows, so that when we got to the Far East, they stood out from the air like a sore thumb. So we were over 3 months at sea, and we landed in Singapore when it had 7 days to live.
Right.
And we really only had time to get our guns off the boats to allow about 5 days of action. Then the war was over.
And sorry to remind me again, what was the division called? Which division were you with?
The 18th Division. It was a Norfolk Division.
Right.
And the shoulder badges were of a yellow and black stylized windmill.
Right. Thank you. So, 7 days to go and Singapore fell. Where were you taken prisoner? What were the circumstances?
Well, the most terrible circumstances, because our gun had been hit and I was sent down to get another one into the town of Singapore. I was a gun driver. And on the way back, I was spotted by 27 Japanese bombers who bombed me out of existence. And I just about lost my right hand in that. I was hit everywhere. And I jumped after the lorry, and in midair I was shot. And I ended up in a post office where the surgeon was operating. And then after that, I don't know what happened, but I woke up again in Singapore Hospital, the Alexandra Hospital. And it was then that the Japanese came in and killed everybody in their beds. They killed over 200. In my ward, there were 71 of us and 4 survivors. And needless to say, I was one of those.
How did you manage to survive that?
Well, the thing was, when I was to be operated on in action in that the municipal buildings where the post office was, the surgeon said, "I'm sorry, son, I can't save your hand, it's got to come off." And I said, "Well, get on with it and save me," because I was pouring with blood. And he got his orderly to put me out of it, which he did by sticking a piece of gauze on my face and pouring ether on it, which was the most terrible thing I can ever remember. Couldn't breathe in or out. And as he did that, He looked at me and said, "Aren't you the magician we saw in Liverpool?" And I said, "Yes, I am." And he said to the surgeon, "You can't cut his hand off, he's a conjurer." Now, I woke up in the hospital with a dressing on my hand like a boxing glove. I couldn't see what it was up in the air. And all he had done was to clean up the wound and put a tourniquet on, which wasn't very successful. I was still pouring with blood. And when the Japanese came along the beds bayoneting everybody, when they got to me, I had passed out again, and my hand was on my chest, and the blood was pouring out onto the bed and onto the floor, and they thought they'd already bayoneted me and walked past. Yes. Now, the next time I woke up, I was lying on the floor of a Chinese girls' high school with 15 survivors of that massacre. And I woke up again and I said to one of the fellows next to me, "What's going on?" It's a funny feeling, you don't know how you got to all these places. Mm-hmm. And he said, "We're in the bag." And I said, "What bag?" I'd never heard the expression before. He said, "We're in the bag." And I said, "What bag?" He said, "We're prisoners." And that's the first time I knew. Even then I didn't believe it, because I thought, when they took you prisoner, they got hold of you by the scruff of the neck and said, there we were lying in this place on our own. The Japs had put us there, I suppose. Mm-hmm. And that was on Sunday, that when the capitulation took place. Mm-hmm. But that's all I know of it. It was all vague to me.
Yes.
But I was actually became a prisoner, I suppose, on the Saturday or the Sunday of the 15th or 16th of February.
Right.
When I got all this happening to me, it was Friday the 13th.
Oh. Well,
my lucky day.
Lucky.
Yes.
Lucky day. So from that girls' high school floor, you were taken where?
Nowhere for a fortnight. I was still in a very poor way, and these other fellows were gradually taken off, I don't know who by, because I was going in and out all for days. Mm-hmm. And then one day, some Japanese came and got hold of me and threw me in the back of a lorry. Threw me. And this is with both these bones poking up out of my arm. Terribly painful.
So your forearm, the radius and ulna, were literally compound fractures?
Completely, yes. And the wrist bone blown out of existence. Anyway, I've got no wrist bone there. And they threw me in the back of the lorry like a sack of potatoes and drove to Changi and chucked me out on the pavement there, also with these broken arms. And I'd also got a bullet through the back of my leg into my kneecap. I couldn't walk, and I was on all fours, all threes really, because this was no good. And I thought to myself, well, I've got to find somebody who I know who can look after me, because I'm dying here.
Yes.
And it took me 2 days crawling around in those prisoners, about 150,000 of them in one area. It took me 2 days before I found someone I knew, one of our sergeants.
Goodness.
And they took me in and started looking after me.
Right.
So I really started, I suppose, on the 16th of February being a prisoner.
Yes. Did you get medical attention at Changi?
No.
Were there any POW doctors?
Oh, yes, there were Major Smythe, Paddy Smythe, Butcher Smythe, I call him, for reasons which I won't go into. But I was in there. They had what they called Robert's Hospital, which was one of the barrack buildings used as a hospital. And after about a fortnight, he decided to do an operation on my knee to try and get the bullet out. He did this with local anaesthetic, which didn't take at all, and I could feel him cutting my leg open. I was shouting and swearing, and he was swearing at me and telling me to shut up. And I said, "Well, I can feel everything you're doing." He said, "What am I doing now?" I said, "You're cutting the back of my leg open. I can feel it going." And then he got a pair of pliers and got hold of the bullet, which was in my kneecap from the back, and trying to tug it out. He was, I was telling him to shut up. I said, "You're taking my kneecap out." He was pulling the kneecap, I could feel it. And I told him what I thought of him then. And so he stitched it all up again. I think it's still in there, the bullet. Quite happy. But that's the only medical treatment I had. I had the usual medical treatment that a lot of them had in Changi for dysentery and all that. We all had dysentery. Mm. But I didn't have anything done to my wrist until a year or two later in Junkai.
So was that hand, that right hand?
It was
hand
useless.
Useless.
For the whole of my, for the next 5 years it was useless.
Right.
If I can jump forward 5 years,
please do.
It was like this.
So it was across your chest and claw hand.
Yes, that, by the way, building the railway like that, and a rope round my leg. And one day, walking down Gower Street, someone tapped me on the shoulder from behind and said, "How is your hand?" And I showed him. I said, it's useless." But he said, "Well, it's not very good, is it?" I said, "No, I'm quite used to being left-handed now. I'd spent all those years practicing my magic left-handed." And I said, "Anyway, who are you?" He said, "Well, don't you know me?" I said, "No, I don't." He said, "Well, I'm the chap you left your hand on."
Really?
And
extraordinary coincidence.
Oh, I do a lecture on the coincidences you wouldn't believe. He said, "You must come into my hospital. We'll have another go at it." And I said, "No, I'm afraid I can't do that." And he said, "Why not?" I said, "Well, I haven't got any money and I haven't got a job." This was before NHS, of course.
So this was post-war?
1951.
So NHS came in 48, so it was in the early days.
Yes, it was.
1951 in London.
It was 50 or 51.
And
he said, "Well, no, you come into hospital as my guest." So he took me into University College Hospital, and I was in there 3 weeks, and he was operating on my arm and my hand, all with local anaesthetic, because he wanted me to move things. And
what was the name of this doctor?
He ended up being Sir, I think, Julian Taylor.
Sir Julian Taylor.
Mm.
Well, well, well. What a small world.
Yes. And I've got full use of my hand now, except for that finger, and no arthritis and nothing, and I'm still doing magic shows.
How extraordinary.
Unbelievable.
Wonderful. So, you're in Changi, you're being looked after by people who know you. How long did you stay in Changi?
There again, the whole thing about it with me is I have no idea of time. When I started, I was in and out of consciousness, and you don't know whether it's 10 seconds or 10 minutes. You know, you wake up, and especially if you wake up somewhere else, it must be hours. And we didn't have weeks as prisoners of war. We had 10-day periods. So it was day 1 to day 10, and then you got your dollar. So within a week or two, you didn't know whether it was 1 week, 2 weeks, Thursday, Saturday.
Explain the, but then you got your dollar. Was that a rest day then at day 10?
No, you were working just the same.
But you got paid?
Yeah, 10 cents a day.
And you got your dollar.
And at the end of the 10 days, you got your dollar.
I see.
And so I would imagine it would have been about 4 or 5 months before we were sent to Thailand.
Right.
But dates, I have no idea.
Were you one of the early drafts to go up to Thailand?
I think I was on the second draft. And
okay, so...
Yes, I think I was the second draft that went up, and we ended up 5 days later in Ban Pong, mm-hmm. where it's the first time I met Colonel Toosey. And he was in charge of the camp there where the bridge was being built.
So at Ban Pong, the camp was already built?
Yes.
You weren't involved in the...
That is the most amazing thing that ever happened, because we had been treated like dogs, starved and beaten and all the rest of it. And when we arrived at Ban Pong, there was Colonel Toosey standing on the platform in uniform, welcoming everybody, shaking hands with the officers and saying, "My fellows here will take all your chap's gear, just leave it there. We were all given a watermelon, and then he said, our fellows will show you the huts they're going into, and there's a cup of tea waiting for you, just as we were booking into a hotel. And this with the Japs all round, he had arranged that when the trains came in, they were to be received, fed, watered, and all their baggage taken for them. Wonderful that was.
And that was organised by Colonel Toosey, and Allied prisoners were helping you, assisting you. You weren't being assisted by any Japanese.
No. In fact, we didn't see Japs for some time. They were in the background. He had laid on working parties from the camp, because at that stage we hadn't really started making the railway, so there were a lot of prisoners in camp who had to be found jobs, such as, for instance, dishing out water, mm-hmm. and guarding it. And so he had arranged working parties of our own POWs to find our bed spaces for us and take our luggage in and give us tea. Wonderful that was.
Extraordinary. What type of jobs did you do in camp and then on the railway?
Well, in camp, I was taught to do massaging. We had an officer from the 196 Field Ambulance who was called Pop Hort. We called him Pop because he was the oldest prisoner. He was 65 when war broke out.
And how do you spell his surname?
H-O-R-T.
Thank you.
And he was in charge of the medical side there in that camp. He taught us to massage the people with muscle waste, beriberi and that sort of thing. So in that camp, I was doing that sort of work. And then we got taken up onto the railway itself. I must say that all my work on the railway, I never had to walk because we were going up in trucks to where the railhead was. And on those jobs, it was purely slave work, pulling ropes and sinking piles in the river and picking up rails and things like that. For several days, I was just on the earth party. We each had a little basket about that size.
So that's about a foot across?
Yes. And it was a saucer-shaped basket with two handles, all made out of cane. And you would have a long line of slaves right up to the embankment, because we had to build a high embankment to put the rail on because of floods. And our job was to take... there were fellows digging like ants everywhere, and you would show them your basket, and they would tip earth into it, and you pass it up the line, and then truck it on the railway.
Basket to basket?
Yes.
Or you pass the basket up the line?
Both.
Both?
Yes. And one lot of baskets was coming down and the other going up, and chain system. And we built this thing 50 feet high for 100 miles.
Just that way?
Yes. And for a long time I was on that. Because
you were doing this one-handed.
Well, no, I had to do an awful lot of it using both hands. The people who were organising these, the Japs just used to say 50 men, and one of our NCOs would pick the people out, and they all knew that I was incapacitated, because all those years I had a rope tied round that foot and to walk with, because it's dropped, still is. Mm-hmm. And this was up here. So if I was carrying anything, I had to carry it on my elbow.
Right, in the crook of your elbow.
Yes.
Right, so you're holding something against your chest.
Yes.
In order to move it up.
Yes. That's right. But when I was passing baskets, I had to use the hand. I used my thumb.
Right.
And there again, it was a lucky thing for me, because eventually we were on the Speedo Wampo Viaduct, which was terrible job, working 18 hours a day. And when it was done, we made it out of teak trees, very heavy. The only job I was ever on where we had to have elephants. And even then, the Japanese decreed that what an elephant would do, five of us could do.
Good.
Which is impossible, especially as we were skeletons, really.
Yes.
And when it was all made, put up with teak trees, and by the way, we had to cut planks out of those teak trees.
So you're doing that on these hand saws?
Yes, one man in a pit, and the tree up onto the earth like that, another one standing on the top, and just doing this all day long with a cross-cut saw. And it would take all day to cut one plank out. And then when it was done, we had to creosote it, which was stupid, because if we'd been doing it, we would have creosoted it before it went up. So that involved climbing up to the top with 5 gallons of creosote and a bamboo with a sack on the end of it, and doing this. And of course, if the creosote landed on you, you came up in the blister straight away.
Yes,
because we were 100 degrees or something like that.
Yes.
And on that particular time, I had no clothes. I had a loincloth, which I still have, and I had got myself a hat. That's all. And the Japanese guard told me to climb up and do the creosoting underneath the rails. And as a result of the time that I was bombed out in that lorry, I had vertigo. I still have it badly. I have no balance at all. And there was no way I could climb up and do that job. And I told the chap that I couldn't. And so he went and got a bamboo pole to beat me up with. So I climbed. And I climbed up there by lifting my foot up with a rope, putting it on one bit. 5 gallons of creosote on here, very, very heavy.
Mm. And on this crook arm?
Yeah, struggling up. It took me 10 minutes to inch my way to the top. And when I got there, there was no way I could do anything. I just shut my eyes and clung to the posts. The whole world was going round. And I knew if I opened them, I'd fall. And there was the Jap from the ground shouting at me to get on with it, or words to that effect. And I said, no. If God Almighty had told me, there was no way I could open my eyes. Everything was going round. I could feel it.
Mm-hmm.
And he came up after me in 30 seconds and threw the 4 gallons of creosote over me. And fortunately, I tapped my head down and didn't get any on my face. But the rest of me started coming up like a missionary man.
Mm.
And I never found out how I ended up in the river. I woke up with fellows washing me. Now, 2 years ago, I went out to Singapore and Thailand, and Charles Peel was on that same trip.
Right.
And I was telling this story, and I said I'd never found out whether I jumped or whether I fell or whether I was pushed or what. I just woke up with people bathing me in the river. And he said, no, we carried you down. He'd been on that at the time. And they got me down into the river and washed me. And I looked so awful with these blisters that even the Japs decided to send me down country.
Mm-hmm.
And which was my lucky day. I went and said goodbye to my friends, about 8 of them who are from my regiment, who'd been working with me, and I shook hands and said, I'll see you soon. I thought once they'd done me, I'd get back up. And he said, oh, you won't see us again. I said, why? Where are you going? He said, we're all going to die. And 3 weeks later, they were all dead. And I wasn't, because of the creosote. Another lucky day to have that lot thrown over me. So all the horrible things that happened to me have proved in the end to be a lucky stroke.
Extraordinary.